All right, does anybody need a Bible? If you need a Bible, raise your hand and Jim will get you one. One over here in the middle, Jim, and one over there. Once you have your Bibles, go ahead and open up to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 26. Over here, Jim, in the middle, and then over on that other end. I think we woke up Jim. Raise your hand back up again, ma'am, over there. I think we woke up Jim up over there. He wasn't quite ready for the hands this morning. So anyway, Matthew chapter 26, we started this chapter the last couple of weeks, and we've gotten down now to verse 69, this area where we see Peter denying Jesus three times. And so we just want to get into it. Most of us are familiar with the story. Starts out here in verse 69. Now Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him saying, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you are saying." And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth." But again he denied with an oath, "I do not know the man." Verse 73, and a little later those who stood by came up and said to Peter, "Surely you also are one of them, for your speech betrays you." Your speech betrays you. See, it's kind of like that with all of us. Once we become believers, if you go back to the fires of the world, you find you just won't quite fit in the same way. Peter was there warming his hands, warming himself by the fires of the enemy, the scriptures say. And now he's trying to fit in, but he doesn't, because they said, "Your speech betrays you." And that happens with us. We try to tell maybe a dirty joke again, and that betrays you. You know, you try to come up with some of your little innuendos, but people will look at you and kind of say, "It doesn't ring true. Your speech betrays you. You're not, your speech isn't what you proclaimed or confessed that you're a Christian." If you really are born again, you can't go back to the old fires. It just doesn't work out. It doesn't work out when you try to go back in, try to fit in to what that old man was. You're no longer that old person. You're a new creation in Christ Jesus. Everything has become new, which means different, and so you're a different individual. Peter was different. And so as he denied Christ the first two times, "I do not know him. I do not know what you're talking about." But then they said, "Clearly your speech betrays you." Now look what he does in verse 74 as it starts out. Then he began to curse and swear, saying, "I do not know the man. My speech betrays me," he says. "I'll show you some speech." He starts coming out. Peter said, as he began to curse and swear at that time, you've got to remember, fishermen were some of the roughest language of anyone. Well, why was that? Well, perhaps because their nets would get all entangled there at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee. And you know what it's like any time you try to untangle something. You know, you work at it, and you know, all kinds of things can start to come out of your mouth. They had ample reason to swear as they were trying to untangle those nets. At any rate, all tangled up himself, Peter began to curse and swear again at this time. He just wasn't able to get with it. And then verse 74 goes on, and then look at what happens. Immediately, a rooster crowed. See, because the priests felt that birds would make a mess and defile the holy city, according to the city ordinances of the time, no roosters or no hens were allowed in Jerusalem. And yet this rooster crows. Therefore, when Peter heard the sound of a rooster crowing, it would not only remind him of the very words Jesus had just told him previously, but I think it would remind him of his own sin at that place. For just as the rooster had no place in the holy city, Peter must have known immediately that his denial of Jesus had defiled and polluted his relationship with Jesus. Just as that rooster was out of place, he was out of place there in his denials and his denying of his relationship with Jesus. And that would have been polluted. It was polluted because of that. And then verse 75. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus who had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So he went out and wept bitterly. See, Luke tells us that at this very moment that the rooster crows, Jesus was being led out of the house of Caiaphas, and he turned and looked at Peter. Just in that same time period, with a look that must have said to Peter at that point, "Peter, I told you this would happen. I told you that you would deny me three times. But Peter, I'm not through with you, and I love you." See, just that love of Jesus for Peter was just would have poured out at that point, I'm sure. And yet he said, "I told you." And remember, Peter said, "Oh, I'll never deny you, even if I have to die." Peter was the one that just stood out saying, "I'll never deny you, Jesus." But yet, not long after, he did. And so chapter 26 ends with that look that Jesus surely gave to Peter as he was walking out of the home of Caiaphas at that point. Now let's look at verse 27. So as he comes out of the house of the palace of Caiaphas, after this illegal midnight meeting of the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish Supreme Court, we pick it up here in verse 1 of chapter 27. It says, "When morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor." Now, chapter 27 is going to get into some details about really what took place with Jesus. And what we really start to see the price that was paid for our sin. We think about this. It was now probably 5 o'clock in the morning or so. After this night of agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, followed by a beating at the hands of the palace guards, Jesus was now led on to Pontius Pilate. Why? Why was he led to Pontius Pilate? Well, it was to fulfill prophecy. You see, when Jews would put a man to death at this time, they did it through the tradition of stoning a person to death. But Old Testament prophecies, however, always say that when the Son of God would be put to death, he would be crucified. A Roman way of putting people to death. And it all depicts him in that because the Old Testament declares in Deuteronomy, "Cursed is anyone who hangs on a tree." So it was in fulfillment of prophecy that Jesus was brought before a Roman governor in order that he might die a Roman death and not just be stoned to death the way that the Jews would have done it if they carried it out in their own ways and their own principles. But keep in mind, however, at this time, the Roman soldiers, all of these Roman soldiers, they were drafted in from all countries around the known world that they had conquered. So there were soldiers from all different parts of the empire that he was brought before. And so although it was the Jews who sentenced Jesus to die, and although it was the Romans who had devised the method of execution, he who died for the sins of the whole world did in fact die at the hands of the whole world. There was a whole mixture of the world that brought him to that place of crucifixion. Now look at verse 3. It says, "Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priest and the elders." Notice he says it was remorseful. He wasn't repentant. He was remorseful. And then verse 4 says, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? You see to it. If Judas had seen any fault at all in Jesus, if Judas had seen any inconsistency, any hypocrisy, or any sin at all in Jesus, he could have justified his betrayal in his own mind. He could have been justified in what he had done. He could have said, he makes himself out to be the Son of God, but I've seen him lose his temper. Or he could have said, I remember the time he stretched the truth a little bit. Or I heard him gossip. But of course, Jesus did none of those things. And so, instead, Judas realized that he was exactly who he declared he was to be. He realized at that point, at that place, Jesus truly was the Son of God. He truly was the Messiah, the Christ. Even though he was disappointed because every time the crowds tried to make Jesus their king, Jesus would sweep away. And because of that disappointment, I think that Judas got disappointed in Jesus. He betrayed him, but himself, now he gets to that point where he realizes he truly is the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. He truly was the sinless one. So if Judas had ever seen any fault in Jesus, he would have been able to justify his betrayal. Now look at verse 5. It says, then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. See, this is interesting to me because Judas hung himself on a tree. In Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 16 through 19, says that if a man bears false witness against someone, suffers because of his lie, the false witness must share the same fate as the one to whom he had lied about. So do you see this, what's happening here? In the scriptures, as God puts everything together from Genesis to Revelation so consistently, as Judas realized, as he realized Jesus would soon be crucified on a tree, it's as if he got as close as possible to sharing the same fate as the one that he had lied about, the one that he had betrayed. This is further proof that Jesus realized perhaps more clearly than possibly anyone else at this point that Jesus was completely faultless and completely innocent as he went to hang himself on that tree. He was remorseful, but not truly repentant. Now let's look at verse 6. But the chief priest took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful to put them into the treasury because they are a price of blood. And they consulted together and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the value of him who was priced, whom they of the children of Israel priced, and gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me. So what was this potter's field that was prophesied? And it's interesting, as you see all of these things that Jesus is going through, it's all fulfillment of prophecy. None of this was a surprise to Jesus. None of it was a surprise to the Father. This has all been laid out. It was all fulfilling prophecy. But what was the potter's field? Well, in biblical times, if a potter happened to discover a crack or a chip or something that was wrong with what he was working on that he had been made, he would take that marred vessel, he would take it outside the shop and just smash it under the ground into this area that would become eventually full of broken pottery and broken shards. And so because nothing else would ever be able to grow in that portion of land, it was good for nothing. This field became good for nothing except to use as a cemetery for strangers or travelers who had nowhere else to be buried. Now think for a moment. The blood money of Jesus was used to buy a place where broken pottery and dead bodies were. That's what ended up, those 30 pieces of silver were used for. And when we really think about it, that's us. That's us. Without Jesus, we were shattered and dead. Without Jesus, we were good for nothing. We were had nothing good in us that would be good for eternity at all. What hope is there truly for broken pottery? What hope is there for pottery once it's broken and shattered? Well, only this. You see, if it is reheated, if it is placed in water once again, it will become pliable. And once again, it will be able to be reshaped and restored, that broken chips of pottery. So too, if we as broken pieces of pottery become heated by the trials that our Master allows to come into our lives, if we're warmed by the love He has for us and washed by the water of the Word that He gives to us, guess what? We can be reshaped and used for His glory. We can be restored and reshaped. No matter how broken we've been, no matter how bad we've failed, no matter what's taken place in our past, no matter who's done anything to us, we can be reshaped and be reformed, just as that broken pottery could. See, that's those trials, those fiery trials what we go through that we just want to get out of as quick as possible. James says, don't rush them. Let them take their place until you become a person of mature character. And so we have those trials that warm us and get us moldable and shapeable again. We have His Word that washes and cleanses our hearts. We have His love that just molds us back together again and heats us up into that way. So we have these things that we can know that we can be reshaped and restored. What a great promise that is. It's a great analogy when you look at that potter's field and see how God can use us, and it's just as He can use broken pottery again. Now let's look at verse 11. Now we see Jesus being examined. Verse 11 starts out, says, "Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked Him, saying, 'Are you the King of the Jews?'" So Jesus stood before Pilate. Pilate, who was at this point really in big trouble already anyway. See, Pilate had already made three huge blunders with the Romans. He had been, at this point, warned by Tiberius Caesar that if you make one more mistake, I'm going to remove you from your post, and possibly even worse. Pilate made his first mistake initially when he came into Jerusalem. When he first got there, as his soldiers carried standards that were topped with eagles of gold and silver on them, he brought them right into the temple area. Well, the Jews saw the eagles as idols, and they became so infuriated that they rioted it right there in the Temple Mount. And so, wanting to stop this rebellion immediately, Pilate ordered the riotous Jews to be held there in the amphitheater, just outside Jerusalem, where they would be slaughtered unless they repented. Well, these courageous Jews, they just simply laid their heads down on the ground and said, "Chop off our heads. Go ahead, chop them off, but there will be 10,000 others to take our place if your images ever come into the temple again." So these Jews didn't back down. Today, as believers, we shouldn't ever back down from the truth of Jesus Christ and Him crucified. A short time after this, Pilate wanted to make up to the Jews for his very bad start that the Jews, for the Jews, so he started to bring in a fresh supply of water. So he built this aqueduct that would carry water from the north down to Jerusalem. It was a great, great engineering feat, but he financed it. He financed this whole undertaking with money from the temple treasury. He just keeps blowing it here with the Jewish community. So once again, the infuriated Jews, it's infuriated the Jews, and blood was shed once again. Pilate put down the ensuing rebellion, of course. And when Pilate ordered new armor, once again, for his soldiers, the new shields bearing the image of the emperor Tiberius Caesar, again, this incensed the Jews, who considered them to be a form, once again, of idolatry. The Jews rebelled yet again. And when Tiberius heard of it, he was incensed and sent messages to Pilate that said, if there was one more rebellion, he'd be out of a job. And so the Jews didn't like anyone else bringing these idols in. It seems like the Jewish nation always had their own idols, though, as we do as today. Many today still have the idol of materialism, idol of relationships, all these different idols that come in, and we just kind of accept them. The world's trying to get us to accept a lot of things today that just aren't biblical, that are not moral, that they're an abomination to the Lord. And so we need to be as those courageous Jews and not back down. Not to back down and not turn away. Then verse 11 goes on. After the question, are you the king of the Jews? It goes on in verse 11. Jesus said to him, it is as you say. And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then Pilate said to him, do you not hear how many things they testify against you? But he answered him, not one word. So that the governor marveled greatly. So these accusations were being hurled against Jesus, but he answered not a word. He answered not a word. Only when the, are you the king of the Jews? He just simply calmly said, it is as you say. He answered not a word, just as Isaiah prophesied 750 years earlier. Again, fulfillment of prophecy. Jesus could have blown his accusers away. He could have given brilliant legal defense, but he said nothing. He said nothing. Maybe this week you've been defending yourself against accusations or slander. I'm learning the hard way. I'm not learning it real fast, but I'm trying to learn that the problem with defending yourself is that you'll never be able to stop. You'll never be able to stop. Start defending yourself, and that's all you'll do all day long. I'm learning the blessing of not defending myself. Jesus is able to do that a lot better. No matter what accusation comes your way, no matter what's said toward you, if you can just say, Lord, you hear that. You know that. We have to take this example from the Lord. He spoke not a word. And I'm trying to learn this lesson, but it's one of those things that's kind of hard to learn. I think you all can relate to that. See, David had found a better solution. He said, let the Lord be your defender. Let the Lord be your rock. Let the Lord be your shield, your fortress, and your high tower. In Psalm 18, as he read that, wrote that out, David chose not to defend himself. Jesus lives to defend you instead. Hebrews 7:25 says he's there always making intercession for us. Jesus will protect us. Jesus will defend you. It may not happen in your time and in your way, but he will bring it through that. So we don't have to defend ourselves. We can take the example of our Lord Jesus and not say a word. Not say a word. God will handle it. If you know you're right, if your conscience is clear, let the Lord deal with it. Vengeance is His, He says. We don't have to take it. He can handle the situation much better than we can, believe me. So now let's go on to verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. And at that time they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" Verse 18, for he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. Envy, nothing that Jesus had did wrong, but because of envy. So that Barabbas here, in Greek is Bar-Abba, which means son of the father. From other gospel accounts, we know that he was an insurrectionist. He was actually a murderer. He was being held for murder. He was despicable, brutal, and he was hated by most of the people. So Pilate, I believe, brought him out because he must have been certain that the crowd would surely pick Jesus over Barabbas. They didn't like him. He was a murderer. They wouldn't want him back on the streets. Pilate must have thought that surely the Jews would want Jesus instead of him. But look what takes place. Look at verse 19. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him." So his wife, Claudia Procola, the daughter of Augustus, she is one that had married Pontius Pilate. History not only tells us that she converted to Judaism, but history also says that following this event, following the crucifixion, that she actually converted to Jesus and became a Christian. Now, that's not in the Bible anywhere. That's just historical records and sayings, traditions. And so it may or may not be true at that point. Then verse 20 goes on. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. So there was those instigators in the crowd there that were just sparking them on, "Oh, say Barabbas, say Barabbas." 21, the governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" They said, "Barabbas." And Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" What then shall I do with Jesus? What shall I do with Jesus? That's the question for every person throughout all of history. What shall we do with Jesus? Pilate had a choice. He had a choice to make it right. He had a choice. He could either stand up for what he knew was right, or he could follow the crowd and save his political skin. So too, there are those who truly know in the very bottom of their hearts that Jesus Christ is the only way. They know in the very heart of hearts he is the only way, even though the crowd all around them is saying, "Don't be so restrictive. Don't be so narrow-minded. You don't want to be a fundamentalist, do you?" See, there's those around us that can know Jesus is right, but the world around them has their ear more than the truth. They want to believe the lie rather than the truth. They don't want to have to be different. They don't want to have their speech betray them. They want to continue to conform to the world instead of the word and to the truth. And then verse 22 goes on. They all said to him, "Let him be crucified." So what shall I do with this Jesus, whom is the Christ, who's called the Christ? "Crucify him," they yelled. Then verse 23, then the governor said, "Why? What evil has he done?" So I think as we listen carefully through these words that Pilate just spoke, I think you could hear the torment. I believe the torment in the voice of Pontius Pilate, who examined Jesus and said, I find no fault with him. So here he's saying, why? What evil has he really done? Why should we crucify him? And then verse 23 goes on, but they cried out all the more, saying, let him be crucified. Cried out even louder, and I'm sure at the back of Pilate's mind is the thought, if this crowd goes, you know, into rebellion on me, I'm out of work here. I may lose my head. So verse 24 says, when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this person. You see to it. So the Roman governor, who was constantly at odds with the Jews, now followed a Jewish practice. A Jewish practice from Deuteronomy chapter 21 that stated that if a man was murdered outside of the city and no one knew who the murderer was, the elders were to wash their hands as an illustration of their innocence in the matter. So Pontius Pilate is saying, I'm innocent of this man's blood because you've made this decision, not me. I gave you a great choice, a murderer or this innocent man. And they chose the murderer. Verse 25, and all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. They got their way. They got their way for years, but the Jews, who are a beautiful, blessed people, would feel the effects of this statement for centuries. For centuries, even though they're a blessed and beautiful people, they felt this statement, the results of it. Now, verse 26, we get into some of the real pain, the real suffering, the real physical pain, the real physical suffering that Jesus went through for us. And you know, they've depicted this in movies, but I don't think movies can even come close to what Jesus' body would have looked like after what we're going to read about here in these next few verses. Verse 26 says, then they released Barabbas to them, and when they had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. So we know from other Gospels that the scourging Pilate ordered was an attempt actually to incite some kind of compassion for Jesus in the hearts of the Jews. Thinking maybe after they see how he looks after this, they won't maybe go the further. They won't want him to be crucified. Because see, scourging was brutal. This was brutal. It was done with a Roman instrument of torture called a flagellum. Flagellum, there you go. It was a whip. It was a whip made of 12 or 13 leather straps. Lead balls were attached to the ends of these straps, and pieces of glass and metal were embedded between the lead balls and the handle. The accused that they were going to be whipping would be tied by his wrist, and then dangled about a foot off of the ground. His feet wouldn't be touching the ground, rendering him totally helpless to protect himself in any way at all. Then the beating would begin once they had him at this place, usually 39 times. 39 times was the Jewish law of the maximum amount they could whip. The first blows that would come upon the body would cause welts to form on his shoulders and on his back. By the seventh or the eighth blow, the glass would begin to cut open these large welts that had formed, not only reducing the back to the consistency of hamburger, but also exposing the actual internal organs within him. At the end of the beating, the accused would be cut down and he would fall to the ground and he would lay in the pool of his own blood. Most men died. Most men would die under this type of beating. But Jesus, of course, did not die there. He was not, it was not prophesied for him to die at that place. Soldiers stood him up. They stood him up, brought him out, and presented him to the crowd. They showed him to the crowd, and Pilate said, "Behold the man. Behold the man." As if to say, "Look at this man. Isn't this enough?" You couldn't even recognize him at that point. The Old Testament says, Isaiah says, couldn't even recognize him. Isn't this enough? Verse 27. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. They were put this scarlet robe, kind of mocking him as the king of the Jews. Now verse 29, when they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Then they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. The Gospel of Mark literally says that they took that reed and that crown of thorns that they placed on his head. They literally beat the thorns into his head, and those would have been 2 to 3 inches long. Kind of like a 16-penny nail, if you're familiar what that size is like. They beat that crown into his head at that point. So taking the mock scepter out of Jesus' hand, the soldiers beat that crown of thorns into his skull. They just beat it into him. You know, we can't imagine the pain. We can't imagine the suffering that Jesus went through at this point, not only from the whipping, but now through this thorns into his head. And keep in mind, with one single word, Jesus could have wiped out these soldiers. He could have wiped out these soldiers and ascended into heaven, saying, if this is the verdict of Israel, if this is the cruelty of the Gentiles, you're on your own. No, but that Jesus didn't do that. Love didn't do that. We're not talking about a myth here. We're not talking about some made-up story here. We're not talking about a novel or a movie. This really happened. This really happened, and we can't really grasp the magnitude of it and the enormous pain that must have taken place. This really happened, and in the process of his scourging, his beating, and ultimately in the crucifixion, Jesus was absorbing it all, and in all of it, he was absorbing it for you and for me. The price that had to be paid because of our sin. Look at verse 31. And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off of him, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to be crucified. Now as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. So because he carried the cross of Christ, Simon Cyrene became a convert to Christ. Can you imagine Simon coming in on this celebration of the Passover, the multitudes of crowd, over 2 million people in the city. He's there, and all of a sudden there's this excitement going down this road, and he's there by the side of the road to see what's taking place. And then he gets the touch of this Roman spear on his shoulder. You carry this. You carry this cross. And as he saw what took place, as he saw the suffering that Jesus went through, as he heard Jesus, I'm sure, as he passed away, he said, "It is finished." And as he said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." Through all of that, this man historically became a Christian as well. God doesn't waste a hurt in any of our lives. Let's look at verse 33. And when they had come to the place called Golgotha, that is to say, place of a skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. Now in the Greek language, gall and myrrh are the same word. Gall and myrrh are the same word. Since myrrh was used as a narcotic to deaden pain, were the soldiers showing mercy to Jesus by offering him this myrrh that would deaden his pain and take some of the pain away? Probably not. I got a feeling more likely it was because they didn't want him to die too quickly. See, the Romans at this time, they enjoyed watching this thing go take place. I don't know why or how anybody could, but they enjoyed it. I know you think about in the Old West when they used to hang people, the whole town would come out to watch it. Why? I don't understand that, but I guess I'm just not made that way. But I don't think the Roman soldiers wanted Jesus to die too quickly, so they offered him this myrrh, this painkiller. They wanted to lengthen his suffering. But see, myrrh was costly. It was a costly substance. Exodus 30 says that it was used to anoint prophets. It was used to anoint priests and kings. Psalms 45 refers to it as a perfume. John 19 tells us it was used for embalming. At his birth, Jesus was given myrrh. As the wise men came and giving frankincense, gold, and myrrh. Why was it given him myrrh at his birth? Because he was the anointed one. As they used it to anoint prophets, priests, and kings, and Jesus fulfilled all of those offices. His name is as anointment poured forth. He's there. Solomon 1:3 says, because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is anointment poured forth. Because he came to die. They gave Jesus myrrh at his birth. And now they're offering it to him here at his death. This costly substance, this perfume-like substance, this painkiller-type material. But verse 34 goes on and says, but when he had tasted it, he would not drink. He would not drink it. He refused it. Perhaps it was because he knew it was a drug to deaden the pain. He knew that would cause him not to feel the pain. Jesus refused to take it. Jesus didn't take any shortcuts with us. He didn't take any shortcuts in any way whatsoever. He went the whole way. He could have ascended to heaven on the Mount of Transfiguration when he was appeared in all of his glory at that point. He could have went right there. He could have denied that he was the Christ. He could have stopped all of these things that we just read about that are so, so terrible. We can't imagine. But if he would have, we couldn't be restored and renewed. He did all of these things so that we, like that broken clay, that broken pottery, can be heated through the trials that he allows us to go through. We can be warmed by his love, and we can be washed by his word. We can find a day we can be restored and renewed because Jesus didn't take any shortcuts, not even allowing anything to deaden the pain that he went through, the suffering that he went through, and all of this physical pain that he suffered doesn't compare with the pain he felt when he had to be separated from the Father for that short time while our sin, the sin of the world, fell upon him. And so we have a God that just loves us so much. We need to really understand how much he loves us. He loves us completely right now. In other words, he can never love you any more than he loves you right now because his love is complete. Agape, unconditional love. And so we can be renewed, we can be restored because of what he did for us. And today, praise the Lord, we get to celebrate the Lord's Supper. We get to have this time now where we can come together and we can partake of the juice and the cracker, the body and the blood represented here. And we can remember. And I don't think it'll be hard for us to remember after what we just read about. The picture that was just portrayed to us, that we just seen so clearly. As you hold on to these elements this morning, we'll partake.